I had no idea what I was getting into, and had I really known, I might have just stopped dead in my tracks, you know.
Have you ever loved a book so much you wanted to make a film about the author? John Dullahan did. Working as an ad man between Los Angeles and New York, sweating over accounts for large corporations like Apple, Dullahan felt trapped and was running on empty. By chance, he heard about legendary poet and novelist Charles Bukowski. He read his first novel, Post Office, a novel about the trap of work in modern society and the toll it takes on the individual. The book spoke to him. Something clicked. And thereby began a 7-year process of sculpting a documentary about Bukowski, of tracking down his friends, family, colleagues, and admirers, of spending all of his savings, and of changing the course of his life. I spoke to him from his home in California, which he shares with his son, two cats, and a chihuahua called Olive, who you might hear fighting with the microphone later in the recording.
So I was born in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then I moved to, my mother remarried, and I moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, during my teen years, and that's sort of very two opposite ends. You know, the San Francisco Bay Area, summer of love, San Francisco, Berkeley, very liberal, free thinking, and then I moved to one of the more conservative places in the country. Lynchburg, where the term lynching actually comes from.
So what was your peer group like in Lynchburg?
Well, it's a very conservative place, but you find that when you're in conditions like that, you find like-minded people, and usually it's a small group, but you band together, and in a way it sort of might make you better friends in that sense, you know, that you feel like it's us versus them somehow.
When you're growing up in a place like that, if it's kind of restrictive, and let's say that your interests are a little bit more on the liberal side, what kind of feedback do you get from the community that you live in?
Well, you tend to just develop thick skin, and it does make you feel like a bit of an outsider. You know, I think anybody who's creative has felt that they just don't fit in with most people. Anybody who's really sensitive feels that. And that may be a link that I have to Bukowski, too. You know, and a lot of the people that read his work feel like they're outsiders. They feel like they're oddballs and they don't quite fit in. And he's sort of the voice for that, actually. He articulates that situation really beautifully. And he's sort of, you feel like he's your ally, you know, in a sense.
So you felt a bit alternative when you were in, let's say, in high school?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What were you reading at the time? Were you reading at all?
When I was 16, I got my first girlfriend, and she read a whole lot. So I read a whole lot, and I really started reading kind of at that point. But I remember, like, Hemingway and Fitzgerald were, you know, Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, we were taught in high school, and I kind of read on my own, and I really, really loved Hemingway. And then the existentialists I liked. I remember reading Camus a lot, and I really liked, and Dostoevsky. I really liked kind of what they had to say, the sort of the grittiness and the realism of it. I really liked. I wasn't into poetry so much. I did read, the 20th Century American, you know, T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, and I read those as a part of high school, but I wasn't really taken with them. And I imagine if I'd encountered Bukowski, I probably would have liked him quite a bit, but that wasn't until later.
Guys like Camus and Dostoevsky, they really are outsiders.
Oh, sure.
They always have that perspective of being outside and sort of looking in, but not just outside, almost like they've been cast out.
Yeah, right. And, you know, that whole kind of existential idea of the world, you know, is chaotic, the universe is chaotic and kind of meaningless, and the meaning that exists comes from the meaning that you bring to it, you know, and that's very much a Bukowski kind of, you know, stance as well. So it all kind of fits in, but you're right. I mean, maybe it does sort of come from that place of feeling like you're different, feeling like you don't fit into the mainstream, feeling like you've got your own way, feeling like you have to find your own meaning and make your own world, you know.
It's always the case that when you take a kid that's, I don't know, creative and open, and you put him into a place which is quite restrictive, they seem to gravitate towards art that is liberal and that is about that experience.
Oh, sure, sure. I mean, I felt like, you know, books were my friends, you know. Now, I think the internet is great for that. You know, if you have somebody that's sort of isolated, you know, the internet opens up this whole world of creativity, and, you know, you can find whatever you want on the internet or on Amazon or on YouTube. You know, you can find your niche, so to speak. Back then it was a little tougher, but you'd find the used bookstores, and I just spent a lot of time reading and, you know, listening to music. So you kind of find your way. But yeah, I mean, I did grow up in, like, my dad would take me out to Berkeley in the 1960s, and during the summer of love, I was in San Francisco during that time. I was little, but I do remember it, and those early memories shape your perspective as well. So it was I remember it as just a very exciting place and very, very different. And the town that where I grew up was, they had a big naval air station there, so you could go across the bay and see all the rebellion going on. But then when you came back home, it was like these were the families of the people that were going off and fighting the war. And actually, the town where I grew up, Jim Morrison grew up there as well. And he went to the same high school I later went to. He was several years ahead of me. But what a lot of people don't know is that his father was a commander in the Vietnam War, going over there and fighting, and yet Jim Morrison was the voice of anti all of that, you know what I mean? So kind of an interesting time. And so the Bay Area was an interesting place. You had the very conservative elements, and yet you had the very progressive elements, and it was all kind of mixed up together. But I think that's the way the 60s was more. You know, after the 60s, there was sort of the liberal consciousness sort of spread out everywhere, whereas I think it was more, there was more of a contrast, you know, in this country. That's how it was.
Were you into the Doors at all?
You know, it was my first concert, actually, was the Doors. My dad took me, and but Jim Morrison had just died.
Oh,
so
no.
They had the remaining ones got together, and it was called the Other Voices Tour. So I did kind of see them, you know, but yeah, my dad was a very counterculture person, and so he brought in all the music to the house. I remember, you know, him walking in the door with Sgt. Pepper's, and I remember seeing that album for the first time, and the Beatles had facial hair for the first time, so I didn't believe it was actually the Beatles, you know. And when the White Album came out, it was, they shut down all the radio stations, and they just played the White Album for a weekend. You know, and it's like when the Beatles album came out, it was a big deal. It was a big event. So I do remember those things, and yeah, it was a cool time to witness.
Did you have any sense of what you wanted to be when you had to start working?
Not really. I mean, I liked English, and I did well in my English classes, so I became an English major, but from there, I, you know, journalism, law, I picked advertising. I wish I hadn't now, but I did. And had I to do it over again, I might have documentary work. I wish I'd done that, but it was not really, it was, now everybody does documentaries. You know, anybody can afford a camera, and anybody can shoot it. But back then it was really kind of this rarefied thing that it was very specialized, and you didn't see a lot of documentaries. They didn't show them on TV except on PBS. And being a filmmaker, again, everybody's doing it now. But back then it was a very highly specialized kind of activity that you went to film school for, and you became a director. But nobody I knew wanted to be a director or wanted to be a doc. I mean, we just didn't think in those terms.
It was a new field. How did you end up in Berkeley?
Well, I'd grown up near there, and I went out there a lot as a kid, you know, so that's just where I wanted to go. I just really loved that whole atmosphere, and it was interesting. I went there in the 80s, and they were kind of reliving the I mean, Berkeley's always been kind of caught in the 60s, since the 60s, you know. But I remember walking through campus, and there was Allen Ginsberg on the steps of Sproul Hall meditating, and they would have marches and all the time about, you know, any kind of political issue. They'd have a march in Berkeley, you know. And they're super liberal there, but, you know, we need those voices to keep ringing out, you know. Yeah, it's important.
After graduating, John moved into the advertising industry, where he worked on some well-known campaigns, including the Power campaign for Apple computers, which featured prominently on MTV. The campaign featured well-known counterculture personalities such as Hunter S. Thompson and Henry Rollins talking about the concept of power and what it meant to them. How did you find the advertising industry? How was the whole scene?
It was advertising was different then than it is now. It was sort of, I think, more glamorous, you know. I wasn't in the 60s and 70s during the real heyday, but it was still really, you know, it was a profession a lot of young people wanted to get into. Very competitive. But when I got into it, kind of what I found was that just they work you just nonstop. They don't pay you much at the beginning, and then you make more money as you go. But more than that, it's just sort of everybody's tampering with your work, and everybody's, it's hard to have a healthy self-esteem working in that business, because everybody's telling you they're either killing your work or telling you it's no good, or from your boss to the creative director to the clients, and you don't have ownership over anything. And that was one of the reasons I think I wanted to do a book or a film, was because I wanted to have some creative work that I could kind of call my own, or that I had control over to a large degree, where somebody wasn't walking in and putting their thumbprint on it.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. You said that you were ill at one stage.
Well, yeah, I'd been working, going in the ad business, and, you know, working three weekends out of the month and working late nights. And so, yeah, I started getting chest pains, and, you know, my dad died at 42 of a heart attack. So I took it seriously. I had high blood pressure anyhow. So my wife checked me into the emergency room, and I was there for a few days and under observation. But it was just sort of a wake-up call to me to, when something like that happens, just really makes you think, well, it makes you clarify sort of, you know, what you're doing, you know, how you're going about things, and what should you be doing, and course correcting. And that happened to Bukowski too. He, in 1955, he had this hemorrhage where he just started bleeding, and he almost died. But after that, if you look at his bibliography and you look at his life before that time and afterwards, you just see, you know, very little writing up until 1950. And then after 1955, he suddenly, like, he realizes, if I'm going to do something, I really got to do it. And his writing output just goes through the roof, and he's writing all the time, and he's sending his work to these little chapbook publications, and he's getting published all over the place. So it's kind of a common thing.
It focused him. How old were you when this thing happened to you?
I was in my 30s, maybe similar to the same age. Yeah, in my mid-30s.
And what was the result?
Well, I ended up making the film and freelancing, and I eventually kind of quit my full-time job for a while. And I discovered Buddhism, and I discovered Bukowski, and which is all more of a just an inward focused orientation. Whereas prior to that, you know, in the business world, I was very outward looking, and I guess I needed to focus inward.
So let's see, where were we? You were saying to me that you were super busy at the advertising gig, and that it started to go a little bit wrong for you.
Yeah. So I think also for a lot of people, they start out in their 20s, they get out of college, they get a job, they work like mad, and by the time they hit their mid-30s, a lot of people kind of sit up and say, is there anything more than this? Well, what am I doing exactly? You know, and kind of a lot of folks kind of look, for lack of a better word, into the spiritual dimension of what they're doing, you know? And so that was sort of what happened with me. I discovered Bukowski, and that completely turned my perspective around. And
how did you come to Bukowski? Did somebody introduce you, or?
Yeah, it was through this Apple project I was working on, and then he died right around, I forget the exact chronology, but he died right around that time, and we were researching people for Apple at that time, and I know there was a Rollins connection, because Henry Rollins, he was in one of our Apple ads, and he referred me to a bookstore in town that had some wonderful Bukowski stuff, and I went there, and I started reading it, and it was all kind of part of that whole time. And I read Bukowski in earnest, you know, when I was working in the cubicle and dissatisfied, and where his message really spoke to me, you know, at that point.
Could you describe his writing for me?
His writing is just, it's just the simple articulation of what it means to be human expressed in the most basic human voice, you know, and spoken from the heart. You know, there's no artificiality in his writing. Early on, maybe a little bit. Some of his earlier stuff was a little more he employed, you know, kind of surrealistic imagery. But later in life, he just breaks it down to the essence. And it's really just the simple expression of the human condition, really.
Was there anything specific that spoke to you in his writing? What was the hook, the thing that kind of got you hooked onto him?
I guess his description of the work experience, but really just his overall awareness and what we might call mindfulness today, but it was really his keen awareness of the world around him. And again, at that time, you know, he was writing about the world that I was experiencing, so he hadn't been dead for 20 years. He had just been writing at that time, and he writes about getting stuck in traffic on the freeway. You know, he writes about having a fight with your girlfriend or your wife, about what it's like to go in hungover to that job on a Monday morning and take shit from your boss. I mean, and all of these common things that we go through, but he just writes about them with a humor and with a kind of, I don't know, he sort of captures the essence of a situation in a way that makes you kind of sit up and go, oh, yeah, God, I've been there, you know?
He presents himself in a certain way in his books. Would you differentiate between the character that he writes about and himself?
I mean, I think earlier on, I think he was, like in the 50s and 60s, he was definitely developing his style, and a lot of what was being written at that time was more, quote, poetic or more surreal. There was more kind of metaphor and imagery in the writing. There was a move towards very basic concrete language, and you know, he kind of took that to the next step. But I think early on, as he was developing his style, his writing was a little different in that respect. But his writing really was him. I think he said at one point, I never let the truth get in the way of a good story. So he would expand upon what really happened, you know, but at the core of it, it was based on his experiences or what he would have done in a certain scenario.
So roughly, what is it, 1994, I guess, around the time that you're talking about, I think, and you've picked him up now, and you can kind of relate to what he's talking about. Are you just absorbing him as an author, or did he become like an influence on you somehow?
What happened was I started reading his stuff, and you could still buy like signed editions for the cover price. I mean, I went down and I bought a signed copy of Pulp for the $35, whatever the list price was, at that time. And there was a dealer, book dealer in town named Red Stadelsky, who was a friend of Bukowski's. And I went in and I started buying books from him, and I got to know Red. He was in his early 70s, and he was just a kind of a curmudgeon-y old guy and kind of a Bukowski-like character. And he was real rough and kind of profane on the outside, but he was a sweetheart, you know, underneath that. And he had all these stories, and it was through talking to him that I got the idea, man, somebody should record this stuff, because Red's not going to be around forever. Bukowski just died, and nobody's really done a book on Bukowski. Well, Neely had done one, I wasn't aware of it, but like nobody's really recorded this story, you know, properly. I thought of actually writing a book, you know, a biography, having never done any such thing. And I wrote a letter to Linda Bukowski, and I included some Apple ads that I had written, because that was about all I had to show. And she actually called me back about 6 months later. I met her briefly at a poetry reading in San Pedro. And then she called me back. She said, well, there's another biographer who is a real biographer. I mean, the guy was legitimate, which I wasn't. But she said, I just get the sense that you'll do a really good job. She got a vibe from me, whatever that was. And so, but she said, you know, you should really think about doing a film, doing a documentary, because the people that you're going to meet when you interview them, they're just fascinating, and it would really make for a great... And I loved documentaries, never thought about making one. But by that point, by that conversation, I had been on the sets of a lot of commercials, and I'd actually shot documentary stuff for commercials with Joe Pitka and, you know, some really good directors. So I kind of felt like, maybe I can actually do this, you know? So, and that was back in the day where if you wanted to record on video, you had to rent a Betacam machine, and it was expensive. It was like $1,000, $1,500 for the weekend. So I started doing that on weekends, and I was doing well enough at my job where I could afford to do that. So that's how it started. Yeah.
Prior to this, you worked on a few commercials. You said you were into documentary films at this time. Was there anything in particular that you were seeing that you liked? You know, even if you're in the creative industries, to make a leap from, let's say, writing copy to tackling something like documentary, especially back then when making a film was actually a big deal, a big fuss. You know, you need a lot of equipment. Was there anything that you saw at that time that kind of inspired you and made you think, yes, I can do this?
Well, I mean, to answer your question, to answer it this way, I had no idea what I was getting into. And had I really known, I might have just stopped dead in my tracks, you know. But it was one of those things where when Linda Bukowski calls you and says, I'm giving you the rights to do my husband's story, you know, for all time, when you get that phone call, it's like you make a decision. Am I going to jump off a cliff, or am I just going to stand here and do nothing? And I just went for it. And it took a huge toll on me in many ways, which we'll talk about, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it was, I was not really prepared to do that. I didn't have the experience or the knowledge or nothing. I mean, I just figured it out as I went. But I had seen at Berkeley, you know, they used to show Hearts and Minds. They would show it at school, you know, once a semester. And I just saw it the other night. And that was one of those films that just you never forget. I later actually met the editor that made that film. But so films like that really make an impression on you. Errol Morris, his films, I actually got to work with him in the advertising industry capacity later, which was kind of cool. You know, then there were... there was a Henry Miller documentary I saw at Berkeley, and there were some Burroughs ones, some Beat documentaries, you know, some better than others. But I remember seeing the making of the behind the scenes of Apocalypse Now. That was a wonderful documentary. And Crumb, you know, the editor from Crumb, actually, I hired him to do the editing for Bukowski, because I thought that Crumb was just an amazing film. So I've been following documentaries for years and really love them. And like Truman Capote said, you know, it's when he was talking about his kind of journalistic writing, he said, it's got everything. Reality, it's better than fiction because it's got all the twists and turns of fiction, but it's real. It really happened, you know. And so Yeah, and the Maisel Brothers films were really influential to me as well. Salesman is just a masterpiece. Gimme Shelter. It's not like a great concert film, but it's a fantastic cultural document, you know. Maybe it's a great concert film too, I don't know, but it's primarily a cultural document. So those were the films that really, yeah, that I loved watching documentaries. So it was like, boy, here's an opportunity to make one. How cool is that?
I think you said that you actually talked to Albert Maysles.
Yeah. So when I was actually making Bukowski, I was working at an ad agency in New York, and somehow I figured out, I think I looked it up in the phone book and saw that Albert Maysles' his office was just down the street from where I was living and working. So I called up and I got his assistant and I said, well, gosh, I'd love to come over and meet Mr. Maysles. You know, I'm working on my own documentary. She said, sure, what day works for you? I said, well, how about Wednesday? So she said, okay, come on over at 2:30. So I came in and there he was, and it was this big open office space, and he had his desk there kind of in the back, and he welcomed me and he asked me about what I was doing. And I said, well, I brought my tape recorder with me. I said, do you mind if I tape our conversation? He said, no. And so I just asked him about his filmmaking. And when I left that first day, he gave me a few of his films and he said, here, watch these. And if you want to come back, we can discuss them. So I did that. It was like an ongoing thing during that period when I was working in New York. And what I really learned from him was, he said, the biggest tool that a documentary filmmaker has is empathy. He said, the minute you sit down with somebody, he said, there's no such thing as fly on the wall filmmaking, because the minute you sit down with a camera, you've introduced an artificial element into that relationship, into that meeting. You have to acknowledge that the camera is there, and you have to bring from yourself, you have to relate to that person with real empathy. You know, you have to really be there with them. And he didn't believe in talking heads. You know, I told him, I said, well, what, you don't believe in talking heads, but I like the guy I'm doing the film on, he isn't around anymore, so I've got to do interviews. He said, well, whatever, you know. He said, you know, what I'd like to do is I like to have somebody doing something, painting a picture or doing something with their hands, so they're talking, but they're not really, it's not an interview, it's, you know, you're kind of getting their stream of consciousness as they're doing this other thing, and it's more unguarded and more, quote, honest, if you will. Yeah, it was really encouraging talking with him. And we talked about the various films that he'd done. And it was really inspiring to me.
Is it something that went on for a long time, or was it just like a quick meeting?
No, it was over a period of months. And I would go back and just talk to him about all the different aspects of it, you know.
So you've spoken to Linda. She's invited you to make this film. What did you imagine you'd end up with? How did you conceive the film? Did you think it was going to be a full-length feature? Did you think it was going to be maybe a short? What were you expecting?
I wanted that film to show at the New Art on the big screen in Los Angeles, and I visualized it up on that New Art marquee. I felt that Bukowski's story was so fascinating and so important that it deserved to be on the big screen. I had no idea how difficult it is to actually do that, how few films actually make it to that point. But that was what I had envisioned. And I had enough material to do like a five-part series on, you know, the BBC or something. It would have been great. But definitely a feature film is what I was hoping for.
How long did you think it was going to take to make it?
I didn't know, but I thought a period of several years. It ended up taking about 7 from very beginning to when it hit the screen. I kind of figured something like that, because I was still, you know, I was working at the time and I was doing it on the side and I didn't know what I was doing. But I just started doing interviews and just reading all the time, and I was just sort of obsessed with it. Like every waking minute was sort of some aspect of that film.
Were you collaborating with somebody, or was it
No, I mean, well, Linda, I guess I was collaborating with her at the beginning more. We were just always talking about it. But it was pretty much, I was doing it.
So you said it took about 7 years to make the film. Can you sort of talk me through the process? You know, where did you start? How did it lead to the next stage?
Yeah, so It started off by just reading anything and everything so that when I sat down with people, I at least kind of knew what I was talking about. Because these are people that knew Bukowski, knew his story, lived with him, lived the whole story for decades. So I wanted to walk in the door and at least seem like I knew what the hell I was doing. And I started, I didn't contact the high-profile people until much later. I really wanted to start with the people that knew, like really knew the intimate story. And so I found a woman in New Orleans named Louise Webb, who had known Bukowski in the early 60s. And she was went down to New Orleans and interviewed her. And that was a great interview. And I contacted Bukowski's first, they weren't actually married, but the mother of Marina, her name was Francie. And she lived with Bukowski in the early 60s. And when he would come home from the post office, well, actually, it was in the middle of the night, but when he'd wake up in the morning, you know, he'd start typing and she'd be there. And she'd be there with him all the time. And they had the child together, Marina. And so, like, and she remembered everything. She was articulate. She was just a great, great person to interview. And so I started just collecting these interviews. And what I would do is I would talk to somebody on the phone. I'd go over to their place and we'd sit down and have a cup of coffee and we'd just talk. And so that way they got to know me and I got to know kind of what the key areas were so that when I came back with lights, camera, action, I knew what the fertile areas were. I felt like we had a relationship by that point. And people responded well to me. They kind of, I think they saw that I was sincere in what I was doing. And I think they saw that I really wanted to present Bukowski in a good light. Now, that doesn't mean that I wasn't going to present him realistically and in a balanced way. But my heart was in the right place, and I think they saw that. The Bukowski people they're realists, you know, and they don't necessarily trust everybody. And Bukowski's the type of person that you know, if you had an exploitative kind of spin on it, he's real easy to do an exploitive thing on. But I really was drawn to his spiritual side, to his artistic side. I was drawn to the pain in his life and how he was able to turn that around and create something beautiful out of that. So that was really where I was coming from. And so I developed relationships with a lot of the people that I interviewed and we kept in touch, you know, over the years, and it was really wonderful. But I just kept doing that and I kept getting them material and doing the interviews and my association with Linda opened a lot of doors so people that wouldn't have talked to me talked to me. And then there's a certain point at which I had, like, you know, 150 hours worth of footage, and now what do I do with it? And so I contacted the editor who had done Crumb. His name was Victor Livingston, and he happened to live in Pasadena here, if you can believe that. He said, well, sure, I'd love to work on it. And so he kind of helped me develop a structure and narrow down and, you know, figure out how to kind of take this mountain of footage and make it into a film. And so we worked together for about a year and a half on that. And then Sundance came around and we had 3/4 of the film edited. I was running out of money, so we sent it anyhow, even though it wasn't a full film. And they accepted it. So we finished it up. And it showed at Sundance, and it was the primary competition, so it was one of the top 10 films in Sundance that year. And then I got a distributor, Magnolia, picked it up from that point. And then you know, the next year it was in theaters. So that was how it went. Yeah.
So that initial period where you were collecting the 150 hours of interviews, how long roughly did you spend on that?
And that was probably 3 or 4 years just doing that. Yeah.
Were you working at the time as well?
I was. And then at a certain point, I quit my job and I freelanced. I was able to freelance and do okay. So I did that. And then I would shoot on the weekends, you know, once a month, roughly. And my wife was working, and at that time we decided to have a child. So just to complicate things, you know. And I kind of can't, like, when I think back, oh, we had a child, we bought a house, I quit my job, I made a film. It all seems just a little crazy to me now, but that's what I did, you know. It like gives me shudders to think about it now, but
because it seems a little bit risky.
Oh yeah, but I kind of didn't think twice about it then. I just, again, it was like, I have the opportunity, I'm going to go for it, you know. I'm much more careful now with my life, but
it seems like a good thing to do sometimes, to take those risks. I mean, they can go badly wrong, but without the risk, there's never that big reward.
Yeah, and for me, there, you know, there wasn't a financial reward, but Bukowski is one thing in my life that it's like a high point of my life. It's artistically, it'll probably be the best thing I ever did, and if not the only thing. And I, you know, I'm proud of it. And when I die, it'll, you know,
it'll be in the world,
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, and then after that, my next project was my son, raising him, and I'm proud of him too. And he's awesome too. So I have two wonderful things that I brought into the world.
How did you find the people that you spoke to? Were they keen on sharing information about Bukowski? Did they want to put him out into the world, or were they closed? How did you find them?
Some were, generally everybody was forthcoming. Bukowski wasn't always the nicest, most civil person to deal with. So there were some stories that I had to kind of draw out of them. But overall, people were glad to see me doing this. They knew that he was important. They knew the story should be told correctly. Yeah, they were cooperative. They were really cooperative.
You spoke with some well-known people as well. Bono, you've got in there, and Tom Waits and Harry Dean Stanton. How was it getting in touch with them? Was it difficult getting them involved?
Well, Bono and Harry Dean Stanton were... Linda had a connection to them, and Sean Penn. Mickey Rourke, you know, I got his number through Sean Penn, through Sean Penn's assistant. And she gave me his number, and I called the number, and he picks up. And we had a great talk. And he said, hey, man, he said, this is great. He said, well, when do you want to film? I said, well, when can you film? He said, let's do it tomorrow. I said, dude, I can't do it tomorrow. I got to get my crew together. I got to prepare. I got to write some questions up. Can you give me like 3 days? Can we do it on a Friday? He said, sure, man. And then he kind of disappeared on me. And I could never get back in touch with him. And I would have loved to have interviewed him. But the Tom Waits was kind of interesting because he, my father-in-law is a stockbroker. He had an assistant, and she, I don't know, he had mentioned the film to her, and she said, oh, well, you know, Tom Waits is a real Bukowski fan. And I saw Tom Waits in the 80s, and he had all these Bukowski books in the back of his car, and he should really put Tom Waits in his film. And Fred called me and said, do you know about Tom Waits? Because, you know, my assistant here at work really... I said, well, yeah. I said, but, you know, I've already interviewed 50 people, and I don't really need Tom Waits in the film. I mean, I'm kind of out of money anyhow. And anyway, this woman, like, she somehow got his information and sent a copy of the tape to him, and Tom Waits called me back and said, hey, I loved your film, and, you know, be happy to be a part of it. So what do you do? So I said, sure. And he was, he's the most wonderful guy, a real sweetheart. And I went up to Petaluma there near where he lives, and I brought my camera guy, and we set up this beautiful shot in this bar, you know. So Tom Waits was sitting in front of this bar, and he walked in, and he said, oh, you can't do that to me, man. He said, I haven't had a drink in 11 years. You can't do that to me. He says, oh, shit. So we went into the pool area, and there was we got a cup of coffee, and we sat him down near the pool table, and had a wonderful interview. But that one just sort of fell in my lap. But he was one of my favorite people in the film.
It's interesting that these guys seem to be fans of Bukowski. What do you think it is that, because Tom Waits and Harry Dean Stanton, even Bono to an extent, they're all kind of outsiderish people.
Yeah, they are. So I think he kind of came from a similar place that they did. you know, certainly alcohol is a factor. I think Tom Waits mentioned that his father was a drinker, and I don't know about Bono, but being Irish myself, I kind of have a feeling there's a link there. My dad was very much a Bukowski character. And yeah, there are also artists who channel the world they see into their art in a kind of in a similar way that's, you know, very kind of gritty and not artificial, not contrived. It's just sort of, they just sort of put it out there, you know. Bono differently through his music, but, you know, yeah. And I think Bukowski sort of, his poetic touch influenced Bono's lyrics. Bono told me that. And Tom Waits was influenced by, you know, the persona. You know, he very much had a Bukowski kind of persona in the early days, particularly. You know.
Yeah, yeah. Did you get any funding for the film, or was this entirely self-financed?
No, it was self-financed, and, you know, I had some money put away, but, you know, I was making okay money at the time. I didn't know where to go for financing. I thought, well, HBO might be an area, but they're going to want tits and ass, and I felt, and I could be wrong, but I felt that they were going to want to show the more exploitative side of Bukowski, and that HBO, now I think they've changed, now I think they're different than they were back then, but I couldn't see them, you know, going for the poetry. PBS, I could see them going for the poetry, possibly, but they'd want to take out the tits and the ass. So Bukowski's he's a study in contrasts and opposites. So where do I go for the funding? And then, because once they give you the funding, they're going to want to shape the editorial too, you know? So I refused to, you know, I just came from like working in the advertising world where, you know, everybody down the line, you know, has to piss on your work. You know, everybody's got to put their thumbprint on what you're doing and have a say on it or kill it altogether. And I was so tired of that. Like, I want this to be something, this film is going to be the way I want it to be. And the expensive way to do that is to pay for it yourself. But that's what I did. I wish I had been more, really watching my dollars and cents more, you know, but I just did it the way I knew how to do it at that time.
You were learning as you were going along?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember the first interviews, I rented the Betacam recorder and I shot them myself, and I asked the rental guy, I said, well, how do I work this? And he showed me, I drew diagrams, and I, you know, press this button and do this thing, and here's the tape. And I let it, the first interviews like looked shitty, you know. Then I got a guy from work who did a little shooting on the side, and he did the next interviews. Then I actually hired a guy who was a professional DP, and he did the others, you know. And the style of the film was kind of rough. It was, you know, Bukowski was very much what you see is what you get. So I filmed the interviews just in people's natural setting. I didn't want to do backdrops or anything that was fancy. I just wanted it to be, you're walking and you're finding people in the middle of their lives and you're having a conversation. And people are more comfortable that way anyhow. So I wanted to really get natural. I hope the interviews seemed natural. I think they did. And yeah, I just wanted it to feel real, you know, like Bukowski.
You have a lot of archival footage in the film. How did you go about getting that?
I just looked anywhere and everywhere. Linda, she pointed me in the direction of certain people who had come by through the years and filmed Bukowski, and particularly people that he liked, you know, who were good people who'd work with me. And I contacted a guy in Germany named Thomas Schmidt. He had been by three times to interview Bukowski, and so his footage was wonderful. That was the, you know, Bukowski driving through the L.A. in the Volkswagen.
Yes, with the German cross.
Yeah. And so that was great. And Barbé let me use some of his footage and different people. So, but I wanted it to feel like, you know, I'd seen, there was a film called What Happened to Jack Kerouac. And you know, they had interviewed, but there was very little on Kerouac. And I thought, well, gosh, you know, I really want the viewer to feel like they just sat down with Bukowski for a couple hours and kind of hung out with him and got to know him. So now it's a lot more expensive to put a lot of, because every second of footage I paid for, in some cases people gave it to me, but it's expensive to use, you know, footage from that people have shot. But anyway, that's how I wanted to do it. So,
you know, I noticed that actually, I think all the archival footage of Bukowski is European. It's either German TV or Belgian TV, or there's something from Italy. And then, of course, there's Barbe Schroeder. Did you not find anything that was made in the U.S.?
That's funny that you mentioned that. You know, there weren't a lot of people from the U.S. that came and interviewed him. I mean, Barbe is European, right? Taylor Hackford, that's the footage that opens the piece. But
that's the one exception, actually.
Yeah, yeah. But no, you're right. I mean, it was mainly the Europeans really got Bukowski more than America seemed to. Well, his book sales were split between America and Europe. But I think that Europe is more sophisticated. They've been around longer. They have more depth, really. And I think, I don't know, it's a generalization. You're going to understand and relate to an artist like Bukowski. That is dependent on where you're coming from and who you are, you know. And like, for example, the German folks I talked to, they really related to the frozen man. There was this passage from Notes of a Dirty Old Man called The Frozen Man. And, you know, I can't really feel because I'm this frozen person. And that was the one quote that everybody in Germany who I interviewed, that quote was on the top of their mind, you know, and that really spoke to them. So, but they're relating to Bukowski from his experience as a child growing up in the household that he grew up in, you know. And I think Europeans have been through things that we haven't been in this country. So I think there's a lot of depth in Bukowski, and I think the European audience gets that. They really get where he's coming from. And I wonder if in America people aren't just kind of gravitating more towards the Bukowski image a little bit more, and the Notes of the Dirty Old Man and the Fuckmeister kind of, you know. And then there are people I've met here who really love the but in Europe they seem to like the poetry more. They seem to gravitate towards the poetry, whereas out here I notice it's more novels. So yeah, so and in his poetry you find more of the depth. So yeah, there may be something to that.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering about the film structure. It kind of hops from impression to impression. I mean, I know there's kind of a straight narrative of his life, but there is a lot of stuff where we just jump to an impression of this and then something else, and then we continue with his story.
Yeah, I just couldn't do the voiceover thing, you know, but Charles Bukowski, you know, was he a dirty old man or was he an artist for the ages? You know, we'll explore the life of Bukowski in depth. Bukowski was born in 1920 in Andernach, Germany. I just couldn't do that, you know. And in fact, I put his childhood towards the end so that when you've seen all this, you know, the way he articulated and all the stuff that he went through, you see that, you know, that it all comes from the childhood. So put that at the back end so that you understand what you're seeing by the time you get to it. You know, the editor, Victor, was really great. And he's really a master at pacing and structure. And kind of what I learned from him is, you know, you say you've got this mountain of footage. Well, there are maybe 10 or 20, like, jewels, like moments that are just that you know you got to put in there. So then how do you do that? Well, you construct scenes around them. And then you have these scenes, and then you construct your scenes, you know. It really helps to have, by that point, you know, after 4 years of filming interviews, I didn't know what I was looking at anymore. And so to have an objective third party to come in there or another person to come in there and help ferret it out was essential.
The other thing I noticed is that we start the film with the drinking, brawling Bukowski, and we end with the soft soul inside of the tough exterior. And that seems like a very, very clear narrative going from the thing that people tend to know and then ending on something which perhaps they're not so familiar with.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, I felt like Bukowski, there's, in this country anyway, he's misunderstood. And so I wanted to present the mythic Bukowski that everybody knows and kind of deconstruct, you know. It was kind of like when I wrote for Apple. So when you write for Apple Computer, you have to write in a way that people that are computer experts read it and they get it. But then somebody that's never touched a computer before can read what you've written, the copy you've written, and it can make total sense to them too. So I kind of applied the same thing to the film, where if you've never read a word of Bukowski, you're going to get it You know, if you're obsessed with Bukowski, it'll satisfy you as well. Now, some people have seen it who don't know Bukowski, and they're kind of turned off because I start with some of the raunchier, more hardcore stuff, and so that does turn some people off. But you know, you can't please everybody.
Yeah, I'm always interested in the relationship between the person who's doing the film, the creative force, and the person that's editing it, because very often the film ends up being built in the editing suite, if you see what I mean. The structure and the tone of it tends to be put together in the editing, and I always sort of wonder what the relationship is or what the balance is between the editor and the actual director, and how much of a collaboration it is.
I don't know. I think it's really... As the director, you have to know that subject matter backwards and forwards, and you get so into it. I think you really need somebody from the outside to come in with more of an objective eye and make sense of it. So when I see guys that are, you know, directors and they edit it themselves, and you know, I think you need to just divide that labor up and have somebody else come in and with a fresh eye, because at a certain point you don't know what you're looking at, you know. Yeah, I don't know how they do that. And mostly that I don't know that they do it particularly well. I mean, I could be wrong. I could be very wrong on that. But I think that collaboration is really important.
Yeah, getting a second opinion.
Don't you think?
I agree 100%. I mean, I think that you get lost in what you're doing, no matter how clear you are when you begin. And you need somebody from the outside just to give you an idea of how an audience might perceive it. What you put together.
Right. I mean, I remember I got off on the tangent of like all the writers like Bukowski who kind of didn't make it, and what did their lives look like, and what would he, you know, because he took an enormous risk in his life. If he hadn't made it, what would his life have been like? And so I was meeting all these different poets, and I saw all the footage, which seemed very fascinating to me, but in fact, you know, I wasn't making a 10-hour magnum opus. I was, you know, and then I got into this whole thing on the little magazine and the small magazine movement, and I interviewed these editors who had these small little publications in the 50s and 60s, and that's all very fascinating. It really is, but that's a film in itself, you know. So I needed somebody to kind of come in and just like give some clarity to the process.
What were your findings then, now that you mentioned the poets that, quote-unquote, didn't make it, the guys that didn't become sort of big stars, how did they end up?
They ended up without a pot to piss in, living hand-to-mouth, struggling, living very hard lives, and, you know, creative people, in my experience, aren't necessarily money people. Unless they get burned really badly early on, and then they, you know, kind of like the Rolling Stones or the Paul McCartney, you know, they get burned and then they realize, oh man, I need some people to help me make this work better. But a lot of creative people, their minds just don't work that way. So they wind up really, you know, you can wind up destitute. And poetry, I mean, you don't, even Bukowski didn't make millions off of his poetry, you know, on a yearly basis. So there was that, but then you'd sit down and talk with these people. Like there was one guy, Harold Norris, who was a contemporary of the Beats. Jack Michelin was another one. And they were just brilliant to talk to. They were just these walking universities of what life was like in the literary world in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And they were the real thing. So it was fascinating to meet with them and talk with them. But what I saw, too, from that was that, you know, when Bukowski quit his post office job in 1970 to become a writer, he took a big risk. And at age 50 to do that, that really took some courage, because most people, you know, would just have walked off the cliff. But Bukowski was extremely, he was disciplined. He was very hardworking. He was just this writing machine, and he was determined that he was going to make that work. I think he kind of creates the illusion in his writing that, oh, he just sort of rattles off poems and the writing just sort of is this side thing that just kind of happens on its own. But he was really focused, determined, and worked very, very hard at his writing for many, many years. And I admired that about him. you know, he really applied himself.
How long was the initial cut?
I think it was probably around 3 hours, you know, and then we just cut back from there. When it got into theaters, Magnolia wanted to keep it under 2 hours, which I kind of regret. I wish I'd just cut it. You know, it could have been a 2.5 hour film.
What are these parts that you regret leaving out?
Well, one piece that's in the special features is, you know, in the book Women, he chronicles all these relationships he had with women. I actually spoke with the women and got their side of it. And one of the more fascinating interviews was a woman named Amber O'Neill, and she actually wrote a book about her experience called Blowing My Hero. So she wasn't shy about talking about it. Sort of uniformly, the women said, well, gosh, you know, I really loved him and I really cared about him, but all he wrote about was the sex, and he wrote about it in kind of an ugly way. That was their kind of uniform take on it, as was hers. But, I mean, she was a fascinating, you know, she'd read his stuff. It blew her mind. She was married. She had children. She came down to L.A. for the weekend and met with Bukowski. They did what they did. And then, you know, years later, she wrote a memoir on it. And, like, you have to hear what this lady has to say, right? So that was one that what we did. Oh, here's one thing that we did that I would recommend. We, and this was Victor's idea, we had what we thought was a really solid rough cut. Then we had a party at the editing studio. Yeah, we brought beer and wine in, and we did a focus group, essentially. And we asked people, what worked for you? What didn't? Did this part make sense? Because, you know, you get so close to the thing, and you're just, you know, you wonder. And that one scene, the Blowing My Hero scene with Amber, it's in the special features, but it was in the film, and women were really put off by it. Like, the women who we had focus group, they really disliked that scene. And so it was really polarized. So we thought, well, if there's a scene to take out, maybe that's the one. In retrospect, I wish I would have left it in, because if it's polarizing, that means it's interesting and it's hitting somebody's buttons for whatever reason. And then there was, you know, Red Stodolsky, who I'd first met, turned me on to Bukowski, and he was in the film, and then I took him out because I don't know, I was feeling pressure from the distributor to keep this thing, you know, if you cut it down under 2 hours, they can have more showings and make more money. So, whatever.
Do you have the alternative cut?
No. There was a Sundance cut, and what happened there was Linda had some major problems with that cut, and she... Yeah, we had some long discussions about that, so I revised it a little bit.
What was the problem?
The problem was there was a scene towards the end of his life where he sees the U2 concert, which Bono talks about. You know, he got really drunk after that concert, and he winds up going home and falling down and hitting his head, and there's blood everywhere, and Sean Penn's talking about it. It's kind of funny the way they, you know, it was like a typical Bukowski story, and it was really entertaining. And Linda saw that, and she said it makes it look like he was a drunk towards the end of his life. And I said, well, I didn't make the footage up, you know. And she said, no, I want you to take that out because it's just exploitative. I mean, I don't think she used that word. And what I later realized was I ended up agreeing with her because, you know, you're taking somebody's 73-year life and you're condensing it into 2 hours, and it's all about balance. So, in fact, he did lighten up towards the end of his life. And so by putting that at the end, it would kind of make it look like he was just going full throttle to the end. But in fact, you know, he had TB in the late 80s, and then he had cancer in the 90s. But between the two, he did go off and get drunk on occasion. But really, it was, you know, he'd cut back quite a bit. So within the proportion and the context of the film, it was the right decision to do that. But we were under such a time crunch to get things to Sundance that I actually showed that version of the film there without her reviewing it. And the deal I made with her was, you know, I'll let you approve the film, you know. And there were still things that we had disagreements over. And she she didn't speak to me for a few years after the film came out because she felt that I was too tough on him, that I showed too much of the drinking. And my response was that, you know, he was all about presenting the truth. He said, I'm a photographer. I just photograph what I see and I put it in my writing like that. And I felt compelled to show some of the tougher, the nastier parts, because that's how he was. He showed all sides, and I felt like I had to show all sides to be true to him, you know? And if it was just a Hallmark card with a big smiley face on it, what's the point of doing a film like that? That's not true. And she later came around and said, you know, you really did the film. And then one of the other highest compliments I got was from John Martin. He called me. He said, you know, I just saw your complete DVD. I watched the film. Then I listened to commentary. And I watched it. He said, I can barely breathe. He said, I feel like I've just relived the last 40 years of my life. He said it was brilliant. And John Martin, he's a tough critic. And he was a fierce protector of Bukowski for all those years. So that really made me feel good.
What did Marina think of it?
She did. I don't think she saw it for a lot of years. She finally did, and she liked it.
She appears in the film for a really, really short time. I'm sort of curious, was it difficult talking to her? Was she not really willing? Or
No. She was very supportive, as was her mother. Her mother and Bukowski were separated, and so she saw him on the weekends growing up, but it wasn't like they had a really close relationship. I mean, his real relationship was with his writing, and then with Linda King, and then with Linda Bukowski. And she was a kid when she knew him. So kids only remember so much. It's more like flashes of memories. So her interview was more about sort of childhood memories, but it wasn't like a detail-rich, expansive kind of interview that covered a whole lot of historical detail, that type of thing. They had sort of a relationship where, you know, they would see each other occasionally. It was sort of more of an occasional kind of relationship. He loved her. He loved her and vice versa, without a doubt.
So you say you screened that at Sundance. What was the reception like?
People loved it. And it was like a big deal. It was a huge big deal. It was one of the few films that made it. It went over big. And I got a couple of two or three companies wanted to represent it, you know, give me a deal. And I think I was one of the two documentaries that got a deal there. I mean, or one of the few films, period. And Magnolia was just beginning. They were just starting up. And so I was one of the first films on their roster. And it worked out.
Suddenly you have people that are interested in you. Suddenly they are people calling you out of the blue that you don't know. What's that like?
It's really shocking. I mean, I remember going to these Sundance events, you know, like the director's cocktail party down at the Directors Guild, and I felt like a total fraud. Like, I'm not real. I mean, I did direct this film, but I'm not a director. I felt very odd and out of place. I didn't really know what to talk to people about. I felt like I sort of somehow got lucky and got in there without really deserving it. But, you know, documentaries, I guess you can make a documentary without having a film degree, obviously. But, it was suddenly... I got the call from Sundance, and I thought it was one of my friends giving me a prank call, you know, but it was for real. And then at that point you hire a publicist, and before you know it, people are calling you like morning, noon, and night. It's great to get recognition for the work you've done. That part is really great. I enjoyed giving the interviews like we're doing, but when your work goes out there and people... it's in the media and people can write or say anything they want about you or your movie, that's a little unsettling. You know, I imagine if you're a celebrity, you just have to develop a thick skin. You know, people say the damnedest things you can't always defend yourself. It's kind of strange, but overall it was nice to get that positive feedback. You know,
were they reviews? What were they like?
I actually got good reviews. People dug it. Yeah, I didn't get negative reviews. It's kind of scary though when your movie goes out there. People can write any damn thing they please. Especially, of course, the internet. It's just, you know, times a thousand. But and the things that they would write, I mean, they're really writing about themselves. You wonder if they even saw your film at all. I mean, it's really bizarre to see how people respond to what you've done.
It's difficult when you're making a project which is so personal. It takes so much out of you. It's coming from your heart, and then you put it into the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's really, But like you said, the internet was fairly, it wasn't new, but it wasn't like it is now. It wasn't social mediaville, you know. So there wasn't as much on the internet, which I'm sure people would have said, if it came out now, people would have said everything, you know.
The good and the bad.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of glad it I'm glad it came out when it did.
Looking back on it, what was the most difficult part of making this film?
It was traumatic. Financially, it was tough. It was tough on my marriage. I ended up getting divorced after the film, but not because of the film, but the film didn't help. My wife was really kind of encouraging at the beginning, but you know, by year 5 or 6 or 7, and you know, it's all money going out the door. And it's my attention going towards this project and not to her necessarily. I think I was pretty good about focusing on my, I kept focus on my son. But I think my wife sort of got left behind in a lot of this. And I regret that very much. And it was really weird when the film looked like it was going to kind of become a success. A lot of people turned on me. And it was just enormously difficult to make a film on your own. I mean, I think anybody that makes a film, even if it's the crappiest piece of shit, they deserve a big blue medal just for finishing it, because you go through so much. I remember after I'd spent my last dime, and I was with the sound editor, and we were finishing up the sound edit, and he said, "Oh, so is this going to be in Dolby?" I said, "I don't know. What the fuck is Dolby? What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, Dolby, it makes it sound better." I said, "Well, why do I want it to sound better?" He said, "Well, if it plays in a theater, you know, the sound can actually kind of ricochet off the walls and shit." I said, "What the fuck? What does that mean?" He said, "Well, you got to go down to Dolby." And I said, what are they going to want out of me?" He said, "Well, I think it's like $15,000 or something." I said, "Are you fucking..." So I go down to Dolby. And I still see Dolby, you know, I drive back by the Dolby offices and like the hair on the back of my neck goes up every time I see that building. And I went in there and there's this kind lady, she was like in her 60s, and I goddamn near got down on my knees and begged her. I would tell everybody, my story was, you know, I'm doing this as a passion project, I'm doing this from her, I'm trying to make a great film, I'm spending my last dime on it, can you, like, what can you do, you know, can you help me out? And she cut the $15,000 down to like 6 or something, but I still had to come up with $6,000. That type of thing was happening all the time. People were threatening to sue me, and you know, people decided that they didn't want me to use their footage at the last minute, and people decided they wouldn't let me use their interview at the last. They refused to sign a release, and it was just this. This went right up until the last minute of this thing being released into the world, and you know, people's true selves came out. You know, it's like there were folks that are they're good and they're true blue and they'll help you, and then there are people that'll just turn and screw you. And so I saw all sides of that, and I think anybody that's made a film has experienced that as well. You know, when they talk about the film industry being a tough industry, I can see why, and it made me never want to make a film again. That's not why I haven't made. I mean, if I were independently wealthy, I would make another documentary, but it's expensive. I mean, I probably put $300,000 into the film, you know, to make it what it was, and I made some of that back. But I there's no way I'm breaking even on it. Films are expensive. I mean, when we went to theaters, you know, I got an advance from Magnolia. They gave me a $40,000 advance. Well, that went right into the print. Well, back then you had a 16 millimeter or 35 millimeter print of actual film, the film reel. So like the advance I got didn't go into my pocket. It went into, you know, the film canisters, which are sitting in my bedroom right now. $40,000 doorstop.
I guess it's difficult when you're just financing everything yourself.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, I didn't have anybody telling me how to direct my film or how to... I didn't have anybody to answer to on that.
You said that you had some people, maybe who were appearing in the film, that were threatening to sue you, that weren't happy with the product. Am I correct?
Yeah. And, you know, I don't really want to go into that. I don't really want to go into that. It was just some people appeared, and then they didn't want to sign their releases, and they kind of held out on that. And, you know, Linda was very unhappy initially because she thought that I had showed, I'd cast Bukowski in a negative light, and that I showed too much of the drinking. And I said, well, my best justification is how he wrote and what he wrote about. And it would have been easy for me to pretty up his life and to cast it in much more of a positive and heroic light, because I really like him. And so it's easy to create this very favorable kind of glowing film, but that's not the way he was. And I really felt the obligation to show the crappier sides, you know, and like that fight scene. And that came together, and Linda never objected to that. She hated watching it. And my grounds were, and I said, look, I said, Barbet's got that footage. He's going to put it out on DVD. And this is before YouTube. I said, people are going to see this thing, whether I put it in my film or not. But if I don't put it in my film, it's going to look like a glaring omission. And it's going to look like I'm trying to cover up for Bukowski. Why don't we do this? Let's show that footage. I'll take out some of the worst parts. And then I'll intercut it with you telling your side of the story, because nobody's heard your side of the story. I think that'd be a fair way to do, you know. And I don't know that she even heard that, but I interviewed her. I asked her in detail about it, and then I cut it together and I showed it to her, and her word was mortified. I'm mortified when I see that, and I can understand it. It's hard. It's hard, but you know, sort of. What happened was, you know, Barbet came over and everybody was drunk. Bukowski had like 3 bottles of wine or something, and they just, it was on, you know. So the time to have stopped it maybe was while they were filming or whatever. But, you know, by the time I'd gotten to it was already in the world, and I felt that it had to be, it was like Maisel said, you know, fly on the wall, bullshit. Don't try to pretend the camera isn't there. The camera's there. Deal with it. This footage is there. Deal with it. So that's what I did. And it shows a very, it was a side of him that didn't just emerge that one night. I mean, that was a side of him that emerged frequently. And then I juxtaposed that with the scene of his childhood to, you know, kind of try to give some perspective to it.
It's an interesting negotiation that I guess has to take place when you're deciding on whether to include something or not. I think you were absolutely correct, because if you don't include it, it looks like it's a Hallmark type of a documentary, and that immediately it loses impact.
Well, and you know, there are little things like when you're making, like I thought we're going to shoot Linda up there at Bukowski's grave. While we're up there, it would really be a powerful moment to ask about the moment of his death. But when you decide to do that, it's like when you see it on film, it's kind of captivating. But when you're there and you've got, and Linda, who was my friend, by the way, and she's very sensitive. And this was maybe 3 or 4 years after he had died. It wasn't fresh, but it was recent enough. And she's up there. She doesn't want to be filmed anyway. And I ask her about the moment of death. I mean, that's kind of a hard thing to ask somebody, you know? So there are lots of moments when you're making a film like that where you wonder, am I pushing this too far? Am I being insensitive? Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the ethical thing? And you just have to kind of make your best call. You know, you can totally throw people under the bus to make a more drama-filled film, but that's not the right thing to do. So I tried to make the film with integrity, both honoring Bukowski, but honoring the people who are still alive. And so I, you know, it's just, it's something you kind of have to search within yourself. What kind of person do I want to be? What kind of film do I want to make? What's the trade-off? What's the sacrifice? And yeah, it's, you know, a lot to consider. Yeah.
As you were making the film, did your opinion of Bukowski change as you discovered more about him and heard more stories about him?
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised by the more dramatic, mythical elements. I mean, he did things that were just crazy. You know, he did things that were just, he was as crazy as his writing in a lot of respects. But then there was a depth to him and a compassion that was greater than I had first imagined. He was just this really contradictory person. Very complex and very contradictory and very multifaceted. You know, he wasn't just the dirty old man, and he wasn't just this Buddhist sage. You know, he was like a strange combination of these various things. And I certainly picked a great person to do a documentary on. But I really did I didn't attempt the documentary to become a filmmaker. I attempted it to really kind of capture his life. And as I was in the process, I realized, wow, this thing's going to be around after me. I got to really do it right. I got to really do my research. And people are going to hold my feet to the flames if I don't. So I really have to make it the very best it can be. So that kind of became my motivation to make it perfect as I could, you know.
How do you feel about his work now that you're older? Some people say that he's like a young man's author.
Well, he lived a long life, so there are things that he writes about in old age. I was just reading some of his death poems last night, and he reflected the life experience through all of his stages, you know. I don't kind of look up to him as kind of a hero like I think I did when I was making the film. I really identified with him. In a lot of ways, I don't now that I'm older. So maybe in that respect, what you're saying is right. You know, I certainly respect his ability and his artistry and yeah.
You've mentioned a couple of times. Well, you referred to it as his spiritual side, which is something that I don't hear every day when people refer to Bukowski.
Oh, it's definitely there. It's sort of that ability to, it's like, you know, he's on the mountaintop and he just sort of accepts what he sees, you know. He accepts the world around him. There's judgment, but there's not judgment. And he's just sort of reflecting on each scene as it passes by him. There's very much sort of that spiritual element that and other people see it too. And particularly in his later poems, you see it. And later in his life, he did meditate. You know, he studied transcendental meditation when he had cancer. And that influenced, I think, his writing. I talked to his meditation teacher. This is one of the things I would have loved to put in the... I talked to his meditation teacher. I said, hey, do you think meditation influenced his writing? He said, well, I actually did a survey with him. You know, our patients come in. It's confidential. I can't show it to you. But he did write down that, yeah, his writing kind of, his overall general well-being and the writing was a part of that. And he felt that it helped. So there's a poem called The Laughing Heart, which is very, you know, your life is your life. Don't let it be clubbed into dank submission. There are ways out. You know, the gods wait to delight in you. It's this wonderful affirmative poem. And I believe, from the research I've done, I think that was written during the time that he was meditating. There was very much a spiritual element to him, without a doubt. There was a wisdom there that, you know, it's just really... Carl Wiesner, his translator, said that he could be like a cross between Krishnamurti and Al Capone, you know, the way he...
That's a nice description. You've got a 20-year-old son now, is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh. Has he read Bukowski? What does he think?
Oh, yeah. Well, and he was around through the whole process, and he's been over to Bukowski's house a whole time, knows Linda really well, and he's very proud of me for the film and thinks it's a great film and really likes Bukowski's writing and is thinking of... he might get into documentary filmmaking. And so we're watching films a lot, documentaries a lot, and we're talking a lot about them. And so it's something that I've done that he is really intrigued by and proud of me for.
So if he makes it big, you might see a return on your investment.
I hope so. Well, he already has. He's already made it big. He's turned out so well, and he's just a great kid. So the universe has thanked me.
You're doing advertising still, copywriting?
Yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh.
Do you think that making this film has somehow affected your work?
Well, I ran a department for a couple of years where we did video stuff, you know, kind of worked on video, so that did help. But no, there's no connection between Bukowski and anything I'm doing today. Nothing. And in fact, I really don't talk about it that much. You know, every now and then, some younger people will learn that I did the film, and they'll ask for a signed copy of the DVD or something. But and it comes, yeah, people find out and they'll Google me or whatever. And but no, it's really weird, man. It's like it's just part of my past. It comes up every now and again. Somebody will contact me like you are, and they'll want and we'll talk about it. It's great to talk about, you know.
You say you're not really interested in making another film. Would you consider it, though?
You know, if somebody approached me, it's really a money. It's a money thing. Well, money and time. As a single parent, it's not something I would have even considered, you know, with after Bukowski. I don't know. You know, it would have to be practical because... you know, I'm like, I'm saving for retirement, man. Quite honestly, you know, I don't have another 300 grand to blow on a film.
It sounds like an episode that found its way into your life that perhaps shouldn't have happened, or like it's an accident that it's there.
Yeah, I think that's a nice way of putting it. I mean, yeah. Although... you know, it was like one of the best experiences I've ever had making that film. It was even for the ups and downs, it was a tremendous experience. I mean, I would recommend to anybody if they, you know, if there's a subject that you're passionate about and you think you can make a documentary on it, make a documentary. Do it. It's the best thing.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Doc Pod. For more information about John Dullahan and other documentary filmmakers, please visit us at thedocpod.net.
So I have a couple of Jane poems, and you want me to just read one or set it up? Yeah, so Bukowski, one of his first kind of love interest was a woman named Jane, who was a bit older than he was. Their relationship was the subject of the movie Barfly with Mickey Rourke, and Faye Dunaway played her. After she died, he wrote some poems for her. One of them is a Eulogy to a Hell of a Dame. Some dogs who sleep at night must dream of bones, and I remember your bones in flesh, and best in that dark green dress and those high-heeled bright black shoes. You always cursed when you drank, your hair coming down. You wanted to explode out of what was holding you, rotten memories of a rotten past, and you finally got out by dying, leaving me with the rotten present. You've been dead 28 years, yet I remember you better than any of the rest. You were the only one who understood the futility of the arrangement of life. All the others were only displeased with the trivial segments carped nonsensically about nonsense. Jane, you were killed by knowing too much. Here's a drink to your bones that this dog still dreams about. Pretty good, huh?